You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Joining me, as advertised, is Grant Newsham from Taipei, Taiwan. Grant, good morning, good evening. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
All right, so let's talk about it. First of all, where is Kim Jong-un? What happened to him? Tell us. I know you know. You're over there.
I don't know. Every story you read seems to, everybody seems to know where he is and what's wrong with him. But the it all seems to be like speculation about the speculation.
And we both know there's nothing better than that.
Oh, yeah. That's about as authoritative as it gets. it is funny to watch because it really, you read a lot of these stories and it does. That's exactly what it seems like, is a bunch of everybody who knows, or but you can tell most of them, they're just making it up with speculation. I think the latest one I liked the most is, oh, he was injured watching a rocket take off or such like. You know, it conjures up image of like Elmer Fudd lighting off a rocket or something, lighting the fuse. So the short answer is he's in North Korea. I think the U.S. probably should have a reasonable idea what's going on with him. But short answer is I don't know. But, you know, something's amiss. But that's like saying that, you know, in 6 hours it's going to be morning. You know, we all know that. And it is just pure speculation from sort of our part, the people who are on the outside. But if I had to guess, I would say something's wrong with him. Do I think he's still alive? Yeah, I probably do. But something's wrong. So that's about as authoritative as I can get.
That's weak. I would think after all the time you've had to think about it, you would come up with something better than that. I mean, you know, whenever you've seen a political figure watch a rocket launch, okay, it's normally from kilometers, right, away, yeah, right, in some bunker, for God's sakes, and you're watching them, and they're in a bunker, right, there's like a window that they watch it through, and it's out there on the horizon, and it goes up in the air, you know, and it's all great stuff. It's like, all right, how could he get, like, what, did the rocket come back down and slam into the bunker? Like, did it explode and he got a stray piece of shrapnel in his neck or something? Like, how? Like, what happened? And so your Elmer Fudd theory is, I mean, but I don't think, in order to launch him, I don't think you have to light him anymore, do you?
Yeah, the fuse is much longer, but no, I don't think you do. But what my point of that is that it's, you know, I've read those stories, and I think I've read just about every story. You know, everybody's got the latest hot tip as to what's going on. And, you know, with this, if you watch enough of these, that you just kind of learn to wait and see what happens. And it's not the first time. You know, he's disappeared for a, you know, good length of time too, and then at the end he pops up. You know, more, he's alive.
Yeah.
So you really do get, you know, sort of cautious about it, and you know, watching the press trying to outdo itself for a scoop with apparently not having any information.
No, they hate that.
You know, it's kind of funny. You know, when I used to have a professor in college. He was this really nice guy, and this would have been, you know, 40 plus years ago. And I remember him, he had been an analyst at the CIA for a while. And I remember him telling when he was a new analyst, that he had, you know, that it was back when Syngman Rhee, the sort of the first dictator of South Korea, was running the show.
Whoa, what do you mean dictator of South Korea?
Well,
he was a great patriot and friend of the United States.
Well, he was, but he was, okay, the first president of South Korea. But anyway, he was a Ri was the guy. And I remember the professor telling when he about his experience that, you know, at some point it was thought Ri was going to be dead because he was an old guy and he looked like he was going to be dead too.
Yeah, he did.
And so all they were all like, everyone was focusing on, you know, after he's dead. And, you know, when's he going to die? And the one of the boss, this old, back when the CIA like had honest people who like knew their subject, the boss says, look, you idiots, Ri's going to outlive all of you. So stick with what you know. Focus on things that you actually know. And sure enough, Ri lived for a good long while after that. And the point was that, you know, you can get into this speculation of, you know, well, when's he gonna die, et cetera. You know, while it's useful to think about that, it shouldn't become the be all and end all of all the analysis and all the thinking that's going on. So, I'll with this Kim, I'll believe it when he's dead, and I just don't know. But I do think the U.S. should have a pretty good idea what's going on. Especially if he has got foreign doctors taking care of him, as he often has. Say that simplifies the intelligence problem considerably when you have foreigners going in to look after him. It just makes things easier. So that's just sort of, you know, my take on it. It's, you know, wouldn't surprise me either way. But we'll need to see some candid photographs of a body one way or the other.
Yeah, one would think. The with his Dennis Rodman hat or his Make North Korea Great Again hat on, one of those things, we need something, you know, that shows us. My heart, though, did take flight over the weekend. A Chinese, website said he was dead. Now, I was like, well, wait a minute. They just don't have carte blanche. They answer to somebody, don't they? I mean, it's not like the United States. So my heart did take flight when that happened. I was like, oh, if the Chinese are reporting it in some way, shape, or form, isn't that the leak that, you know, that's how they get it out there? So I took solace in that. And I thought that maybe he would, in fact, be dead. But even now, you can't even rely on the Chinese media to tell the truth anymore.
Not really. It's a big place, and you do get a lot of stuff coming out of China that you think, well, you know, since it comes from China, and if they don't like what you say, they shoot you. You know, you'd kind of think it was true, but when it's something like Kim being alive, that's a little different than Xi Jinping being alive. You know, it's overseas, so it.
So yeah, it doesn't really count.
Yeah, but China's next door to North Korea, so you think somebody there might have some good idea, and I'm sure the Chinese do, but they're not. I think going to give us any advance notice.
The my guest Grant Newsham this morning, former longtime friend of All Marine Radio, and former intel officer. He is, I don't know how I would appropriately introduce Grant. Grant was toiling in the back 40 while the world in the Pacific Rim helping the Japanese conduct operations like Iron Fist. And the first LNO to the Japanese Self-Defense Forces, yay. Officially?
Yes, that's right.
Uh-huh. All right. How about that for my having your bio memorized? And then lo and behold, we pivot to the Pacific. So Grant was, you know, Pacific Rim before Pacific Rim was cool. And actually, truth be told, he was Pacific Rim when it really wasn't cool. And you don't know this, and neither did I, till he snapped one day when I asked him about the Army presence in the Pacific. He does not like the Army's ass hoarding in on the Pacific, which is the domain of the seagoing folks. So anyway, I've stayed away from that because clearly he's got an issue with that. But I've got an email for you. Matt, it's not Matt. It's Mac, by the way. Matt, could you ask Grant what he thinks of Marines not taking the PFT this year in the first half of the year because of the COVID-19 thing? Thanks. So I'm not sure if you saw that, Grant, but the Commandant said we don't have to take the PFT, right? So a culture that embraces, improvise, adapt, and overcome, not so much when it comes to this pandemic of COVID-19. We can't figure out a way to take a physical fitness test and social distance. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I would have thought that being on the breaching party in Fallujah was difficult, not figuring out a way to take a PFT. It's one of those things that you kind of wonder. It can't be that hard. I don't. I can't. I don't get it. Is it the? What does one say? I think if you were to turn it over like to any sergeant and say, okay, figure out a way to get everyone a PFT without getting infected, they'd figure it out.
It would start with this. All right, sir, I'm going to sit here in my lawn chair and I'm going to do one guy every 30 minutes from now until June 30th. And I think I'll be done on like May 14th. How's that for you? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, yeah, it's a tough one. I don't understand that.
All right. Just checking. All right. Now, let's talk about the Australians in the South China Sea. Is that a big deal? The Australians have been fairly vocal relative to China and the COVID-19 thing, and now it seems like they're backing it up a little bit, yay or nay?
I think it is. What you're referring to is the just recently the USS America, the newest, biggest amphibious ship we've got, was down in the bottom of the South China Sea, down near Malaysia, with a couple of U.S. Navy ships along with it, and an Australian frigate joined up, and they did sort of Navy things together down there. And nearby, the Chinese Coast Guard and a sort of a semi-governmental, or they're all governmental, survey ship was in Malaysian waters while the Malaysians were there standing off with them or hoping they went away. To get the Australians up there in for a sort of an exercise or to do some things which were clearly designed to challenge the Chinese, that is a significant thing. The Australians have always been very good about being around in the South China Sea. They fly over flights and send ships through periodically, in fact, often. But to have them link up with the Americans in this particular case was a good thing to see, particularly since the Chinese have really been sort of yelling at the Australians and threatening them, particularly with economic retaliation. They're not going to import Australian products, et cetera, et cetera. And the Chinese ambassador in Canberra was just the other day was just viciously attacking and threatening the Australians. The Australians, it's good to see them having, also gotten their military into the mix, where it is all the time. They've really have been with us in the last few years when this has gotten much hotter with the Chinese. They're still a small force, but nonetheless, they've got some backbone. The Australian government seems to be standing up to the Chinese as well, demanding answers and an investigation about the origins of this Chinese virus. And the Chinese really don't like that at all. But they say the Australians seem to be sort of standing firm. You do have in Australia, just like we have in America, you do have a part of the business class, which are basically on the Chinese payroll. And these are very rich, prominent business tycoons who are advocating just rolling over and giving the Chinese everything they want. So you do have that dynamic in Australia, but for now, and really for they've been, I think, our best friends, our best allies in all of this. And they were the first ones about 3 or 4 years ago to really wake up to the extent of Chinese influence in their country and to try and do something about it. So having that Australian ship up there was a good thing. It'd be nice if everyone had stuck around a little longer. As I'm told the Malaysians are feeling not very happy because they think the Americans came and they sailed around for a bit. Now they've gone and they've left the Malaysians to face the Chinese by themselves. That, of course, doesn't mean the Malaysians couldn't offer to host U.S. forces if they wanted. So it sort of works two ways. If they're expecting our thoroughgoing help, there's a few things they could do also.
Could you take us down? Can you take us down through, give us kind of a status report on, we've talked about Vietnam. And I've got an email about that. Let me do Vietnam first. Email. Mac, question for Grant. I heard you talk about how important you thought the Roosevelt's visit to Vietnam was, and that were you either 7th Fleet or Navy Pacific Command, you would have said, we've weighed the risks relative to the COVID virus, and we will execute the port visit because you thought it was that significant. Have you asked Grant that? Sorry if I haven't heard it. Curious to hear what he would say. So, Grant, the Roosevelt into Vietnam was not a small event. Faced with the balancing the public health crisis and the Roosevelt into Vietnam, if you were Navy Indo-PACOM, what would you have decided? What would you have told people to do?
If it was me, if I had got promoted 5 more times, I would have. No, if it was me, I would. I'd have taken my chances. I think based on sort of what was publicly known, at least about the virus risk at that time. So I'd have taken my chances. Of course, if afterwards it turns out there was some virus floating around, I wouldn't be complaining about it. It is what it is, and. They took their chances and they got dirtied up a little bit. But the significance of getting into Vietnam, doing things with them, that is considerable from a political perspective as well. I think everyone knows that Vietnamese are the one country in the ASEAN region that will take on the Chinese. And I think they always will. It goes back a long ways, of course, but they're the ones that are standing up. They send out their Coast Guard, out their Navy, their fishing boats into waters where the Chinese are out looking for blood. The Chinese recently sank a Vietnamese fishing boat and did not pick up the survivors. There were some other Vietnamese boats around that did, but there's been other Vietnamese boats that have been sunk and that everyone has just has gotten killed. So for the Americans to get down there with an aircraft carrier to sort of show we've got at least an alignment of interests. One doesn't want to overstate the depth of the U.S.-Vietnam relationship just yet, because it's not like it isn't like the Vietnamese are all in with us. They have to hedge their bets as well a little bit and be careful what they do. Plus, Vietnam is run by a communist, really corrupt communist dictatorship. This ruling class at the top is pretty bad. About the only thing you can say is that a lot of them don't like China, but the venality, the corruption is pretty serious. And there are some who would take a sort of a very soft line towards China, if not actually be very accommodating. But in general, when you say Vietnam, there's no love for the Chinese there, period. But at that top ruling class level, the regime level in Vietnam, that's, I think, problematic. It has some problems, but by and large, for us to get in there to Vietnam was a good thing. And I think it's a risk worth taking. Once they did get the virus, apparently from as a result of that. At that point, you know, everybody says, how stupid could you be? What were you thinking? Blah, blah, blah. So, but that's the way it always goes.
The well, you know, it's interesting. And the more they've refined their research on how the virus got to the ship, it didn't come from the port visit. It came.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
It first showed up in the aviation squadron that does the CODs. So they believe it came from crew members, you know, going off the ship, flying off the ship to Japan, to Guam, to wherever they were, the Philippines, right? Spending the night, coming back the next day. And so they don't believe it came from the port visit, that the steps the Vietnamese took and the steps the ship took prevented that. But they did get it via the, you know, leave it to those fucking aviators, right? To screw it up whenever they have the chance. Next question. Could you take us to Malaysia? Paint a picture for us relative to Malaysia and the United States. So what I want to do is kind of go from Vietnam to Malaysia to Indonesia and kind of give us a status report on, you know, are they open to relationships with the United States, their relationship with China as we go forward. And this is all under the guise of trying to fight inside the weapons engagement zone. But if you're already in Vietnam, if you're already in the Philippines, and you're doing cooperative military exercises, you have economic and diplomatic relationships, then there's no, you're not going to have a war down there. I mean, the juice is not worth the squeeze for the Chinese, but you got to be there. And so we've talked about that before. So trying to paint a picture, take us to Indonesia, next. So,
okay. We'll go to Malaysia first. Since okay. That's where we were. The, you know, Malaysia's, you know, we've got a decent relationship with them. You know, we have for a good long while. And that goes back even. Malaysia used to be run by a fellow named Mahathir, who came back actually recently as the head, and it was just kind of overthrown it was legal, but he's now out of office. But Mahathir has been the guy down there for a long time, and he's 90 something now, but back in but he was the prime minister for a good long while, back in the 90s, particularly the 90s is when it was hot. And he is kind of a Malay racist. You know, if you listen to him, you know, he is, you know, that's kind of what he is, but he's actually sounds like he's very anti-West, anti-American, but then you watch what he always did. And he always made sure the American, you know, Navy came around the American ships, and that the military relationship stayed with the Americans stayed pretty good. And that is one way. That's how I tend to look at it, is us and the Malaysians. There may be a sort of something. There's talk. You hear language used towards America, towards the West, that kind of makes them sound like they don't like us. But I think basically it's a pretty good relationship overall. With the Malaysians, and we routinely exercise with them, and, you know, port visits, et cetera, et cetera. And the Marines do training with the Malaysians as well. Some reasonable amphibious training. It sort of plateaued in terms of complexity and what they do, but nonetheless, the Marines do show up and we do things with them. So it's a pretty good relationship. But the Chinese, over about the last 15 years, have gotten very deep economic and, as a result, sort of influence and sort of an inroad into Malaysia with huge investments down there. And a good about maybe 25-30% of the Malaysian population is of Chinese origins. And as a result, the Chinese really got their claws into it after Mahathir stepped down the first time. There was a guy named Najib who became the prime minister, and he was as corrupt. Well, Mahathir was corrupt too, but Najib somehow even outdid him. And he had a wife who was like Imelda Marcos, and they basically looted the country, and the Chinese bribed and, you know, just were able to get Najib on board. So he really opened it up to the worst sort of Chinese investment. And along with that came political influence that made Malaysia look like a little bit iffy from our perspective, and certainly caused some concern. But Najib was overthrown for corruption, or he lost an election, and now he's been arrested, etc. So that's a really long way of saying Malaysia, we've got a decent relationship with them. The Chinese do have considerable influence down there, but we have something to work with if we want. But you wouldn't say they're our ally, but you wouldn't say they're our enemy either. They, you know, it's we're sort of, it's on the, you know, to some degree on the plus side of the ledger in terms of our relationship. One of the problems is that we tend to show up there as opposed to sort of being around all the time. And like I'd mentioned earlier, the Malaysians do kind of have this feeling that, well, you're only here once in a while. The Chinese in the area all the time are much closer. So the test for us is how do we improve on that? You know, what do we do to convince the Malaysians that we are serious? But it, also at the same time, the Malaysians haven't offered up to host us, to host U.S. forces. Although it's not well known, but there's a, I think an Australian squadron, which is up in Butterworth at the airbase up there, which is up on the basically the north left, the northwest side of Malay Peninsula, just across from Penang. The Australians have had this presence there for a long while, which gets overlooked. And it, I think, is an opportunity on which to build. So Malaysia's, you know, it's... you know, you look at, I look at it and I see the opportunity if we make the right sort of effort. But there's like a lot of things, there's competing ideas and down there. So, boy, that was a long way to long winded.
No, well, I think it's important because I mean, to me, that's I think that's the appropriate place to steer. If you're, you know, if you were the head of one of those countries, I mean, it's where I would steer it. You want to have economic ties, but you are certainly leery of everything that goes with, you know, getting near the Chinese, and you don't want to do, you don't want to get too close to those jackasses. But the United States, you know, backing out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the United States hasn't opened a door yet. And so we'd like to, we see, you know, the positive things that can come out of it, but the United States is so fickle, here in the region that we dare not, you know, load our chips on the United States. So I think that portrait that you paint is significant because it does explain why they're there. We have not been the partner and ally to them that we probably should have been.
You know what we do think, and yeah, that's ultimately at the end. That's at the end of the day. You know, have we done everything we should and everything we could have done, or haven't we? And that's the bottom line. It doesn't matter if we do have done some decent things and have an okay relationship. You know, we need something more. Maybe of interest, I think, particularly for All Marine Radio listeners, is that about five years ago, five, six maybe, the Malaysians actually asked us to help them create a Marine Corps. And they were serious. There was this window of opportunity, and they literally said, help us make a Marine Corps. And you probably imagine, guess how this ends, but the Marines basically dropped the ball. They had an opportunity, and what they assumed that because the Malaysians said they wanted this, that the Malaysians would come up with a detailed plan with what timelines and, you know, whatever they are, you know, like a nice slide deck laying out this, right, these milestones and plan of action or whatever you call it, the way we would do it. And of course, that was never going to happen. So the Marines waited around for some months, and like nothing happened. And they made some inquiries, and you know, nothing. There was nothing. The Malaysians said, "Yeah, we want it," but they weren't going to do it. They weren't going to go about it the way we would. And the Marines should have said, "Okay, we get it. We're going to do it for you. We're going to tell you exactly what we need to do." And this is how we're going to make it happen. But they also needed to get an officer to the right ones, down there full time influencing to make this happen. But we sort of sat back and sort of in receive mode, and nothing ever, Malaysians weren't going to figure it out on their, do it the way we did it. And by not sort of jumping on this and doing and pulling it sort of across the start line, even the Marines, the window eventually shut and people move on to other things. There was even a push from the Malaysians for something called ASEAN Ready Force, which would have been like an amphibious force, ideally with some other ASEAN partners and even with opportunities for the Americans to get involved. And it would have set itself up, you know, as a sort of an amphibious unit, and used that as the platform to develop a real amphibious capability. And the opportunity for the Americans to get in on the ground floor there existed, but we didn't do anything with the opportunity. I think the Marines should be, you know, sort of more energetic in taking advantage of these things and deploying the right people to them to make it happen. And we don't seem to do that very well. But so we say it was a lost opportunity down there. One likes to think windows open back up. But I remember very well when this was happening, because we had the chance, and you know, it would have taken a fraction of the effort that goes into planning a Marine Corps ball to get it done. But we didn't do it. So
No, you can see, you know, and I have Barack Obama in my head, and you know, you saying strongly worded, you know, statements condemning XYZ act of the Chinese, and then nothing changes, and they watch the Chinese get closer and closer, and so it's just. It's just disturbing, right? Just disturbing when you see the way we act. All right, keep going. Take us through. Take us over to Indonesia.
Okay, Indonesia it's different actually than Malaysia. Not surprisingly, the Indonesians, I've heard them described as the. Sort of the prettiest girl at the dance who expects everybody to come and line up begging to dance with them. And it kind of makes it, you know, the guy who told me I'd be inclined to listen to him. And so they're not, they may be difficult for us to deal with to some extent, you know, in the sense they're always guarded and sort of not willing to go all in with us. But at the same time, they don't like the Chinese very much at all. And that is something that will be, I think, a headache for the Chinese anytime they try to operate down in that area. So I think, and in fact, I would say that the Indonesians dislike the Chinese. Their dislike for the Chinese is far greater than any sort of reluctance they have to deal with us. Which is so that's something that's in our favor. The Australians have a pretty good relationship with the Indonesians. It's a little Indonesians can be quick to take offense about all sorts of things, but the Australians, they're just across the river, the water from the Indonesians. So they actually they know Indonesia, we you know, have a reasonable defense relationship with them as well. But when we try to do things, you know, we tend to, you know, it's try to deepen the relationship. The Indonesians will often pull back, but they, as noted, the Chinese have not made any real military inroads in terms of engagement with the Indonesians. The military there, the Marines are very well regarded in Indonesia. As I say, the Indonesian Marines, partly because they're not—they're pretty honest. So you can—the Indonesian military has had has sort of given like Chicago City government a run for its money in terms in that area. So if you get to say promoted to a certain position, It can be very lucrative there. So that's one of the things they have to deal with. But it does have a military that's able to do things. And as you've noted, as we've seen, there's these islands off of the west of Indonesia called the Natuna Islands, these little places and there's fishing. That's the big thing. The Chinese fishing boats have all, of course, pushed their way in and tried to drive everyone else out in these traditional Indonesian fishing grounds in Indonesian waters. The Indonesians have more than most other regional nations have been willing to push back, and for many years were seizing Chinese boats and blowing them up with nobody on them publicly as a way to say we're going to defend our territory. And that's, I think at the bottom line, the Indonesians are not likely to roll over and let the Chinese just push them around, say, the way the Filipinos do, or the even the Malaysians kind of, may not like it, but they may not have a whole lot of choice. But the Indonesians are the ones who will fight back. It's the country, of course, is a sort of chaotic place, of course, and it's, it's largely Muslim, has a Christian community, which is generally under attack of some sort. And then it's the Indonesians are over in sort of what's the western half of Papua New Guinea as well. So in Indonesia, we do have some opportunities. They did ask a few years back if the Marines would send a liaison officer and assign them to the Indonesian Marine Corps, which, could have been done. But one of the problems that you have in Indonesia, like a lot of Asia, is that the Marine Corps is under the Navy, and the Navy is not particularly cooperative when it comes to doing a lot of things. And this was one of those things they weren't that cooperative with. But there was always a way to work something out. But I guess this one fell into the too hard to do category, which it wouldn't have been for the right major or captain. But that's how we do it. The thing that's worth noting when you think of Indonesia is on the east side of the Indonesian archipelago, down to the south a little bit, is the country called Timor Leste, which used to be East Timor. And it's not a big place, but it has got some excellent airfields and harbors. And the Chinese have got their claws into the place, unfortunately. And that is strategic territory. And the Timorese 10 years ago did beg the Americans to come and do whatever they wanted there and to bring their friends. But like a lot of things, ball season came up and the Americans didn't jump on the opportunity. And sometimes if you don't jump, the opportunity moves to the next guy. It's not the Chinese haven't got the place locked up, but they've definitely made some serious inroads. And if you look at the East Timor on the map, you can see why it is very useful geography down in that part of the world.
All right, next question, another email. Hey, Mac, I'm confused about the geography. And so I would like Grant to explain it to us. And then after he's done doing that, could he rank by order of significance where he thinks we should start and who has the most bang for the buck for us in the region? Okay, so could you walk us around, so I think we all know where Vietnam is. Right. And if we go south from Vietnam, we run into Malaysia and Singapore. Can you explain that whole lash up to us geographically?
Yeah, it's let me see if I can figure it out. One way, the way that it's sometimes helpful to look at if you haven't got a map in front of you, is if you take Vietnam, and I think most of us, if you're a certain age, you'd know where that is. And you're kind of going around the outside of what is a really big bathtub is one way to look at it. So if you go south from Vietnam, you come to first Cambodia and then Thailand as you're going down the left or the west side of the bathtub. So Cambodia, then Thailand, then Malaysia, so it keeps going down, and then at the bottom of Malaysia is Little Singapore, and then you start swinging around to the right or to the east, and you come to Indonesia, and you keep going around to the east to through Indonesia, and then you come back to the sort of the east side of Malaysia, and another part of Indonesia. It's called Borneo. So that's, by the time you're there, you're down at the lower right side or the southeast side of this bathtub in sort of East Malaysia, Borneo, Indonesia. And then it keeps going. You go up the right side of the bathtub and you come to Mindanao, to the southern Philippines, and you keep going up to the Philippines. So it's like a bathtub with Vietnam on the top left, on the sort of the top left, and then Thailand as you're going down the side, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, and then you're sort of moving around to the right through Indonesia, up through the Philippines, and then you're sort of back where you at the top part of the bathtub. That's how I would put it.
Got it. So southwest of the Philippines, that land mass is Borneo, yes?
Borneo is this huge island. Right. And on the left side of the top left of Borneo, you have something called East Malaysia, which is, like the name says, the eastern part of Malaysia, separated from Peninsular Malaysia, which is on way to the west on the left side of the bathtub. Also Brunei, the little one time oil rich enclave, is tucked in there in East Malaysia as well. But Indonesia has most of Borneo, Malaysia has a smaller part, and Brunei is in there as well.
Got it.
And if you're trying to sort of fight through that bathtub, there's a lot of islands, a lot of coastline there, and just very few straits or gaps to get through. And so it's excellent defensive position if you look at it from that perspective. So even if somehow China is able to assert dominance inside the bathtub, trying to get over the edges or else, you know, is that can be a challenge if an opponent or opponents set things up right, particularly with anti-ship missile technology and smart mine technology being what it is.
Right.
It can be a very difficult place to operate.
There's an East and West Malaysia, although you don't really refer – you hear that. So the island that Indonesia – that we identify with Indonesia and that has Brunei on it. So Indonesia would be on the southeast part of that island, and then you cross the border, and that would be – then you're in West Malaysia or East – yeah, West Malaysia, and then Brunei is its own country at the kind of northwest side of that.
On Borneo, it's sort of the top, the northern side of it that's largely where East Malaysia is. The one thing to keep in mind, besides Borneo, if you go sort of look below Borneo, then you have the island of Java, and Java is a big long island. Then that's the main one of the two main islands of Indonesia. There's some others, but Java is the big one, and that's this long island below Borneo, sort of the bottom of the bathtub. Right. And if you go, and then sort of going up just across, if you keep going west and upwards, you come to Sumatra. And Sumatra is actually, when you look at the map, it's actually on the other side. Most of it is on the other side of the Malay Peninsula, so the other side of Malaysia, which is why you get the Straits of Malacca, the strategic strait through which so much sea traffic goes. Hopefully gives sort of an image of it. But Indonesia is a huge place, a huge population. I think well over a couple hundred million people. And it's got a lot of islands. And once again, it's good defensive terrain.
So when I look at Sumatra, right? I see the provinces of what? North Sumatra, South Sumatra. That's what I see. And that would be on kind of the northwest part of Java.
Yeah, it extends west and then northwest of Java.
Got it.
You look, it's almost like the bottom part of the bathtub, with Sumatra being the sort of the bottom left. But it's actually, when you look at the, you have to look at the geography, and you see that most of Sumatra is actually, or a good chunk of it is actually to the west of Malaysia. And that's sort of like a double layer almost. And down in that bottom left of the bathtub, there's like two sort of a double layer, Malaysia and then Peninsular Malaya, and then Sumatra behind it.
Second part of that email was, can you rank in terms of what you believe significance relative to significance to our strategic goals in the region, rank them vertically from top to bottom, those nations that surround the South China Sea?
Yeah, and it's an important subject, you know, to think through how you are going to influence the region. How are you going to convince these nations that you're going to be there, regardless of what the Chinese do, that America is going to be there as a powerful force that will serve as a counterbalance and ultimately protect these nations from Chinese domination. It's really easy to start at the bottom, and that would be Cambodia, that has the Cambodian leadership has been in China's payroll for some years now. Whether or not that's a hopeless cause, I don't know. There are Cambodians who don't like that, but that's the one place that China's, you know, has really got, you know, just got it in its pocket. But that's just Cambodia. So what I would do, actually, to get started, you know, if I had to say, like, tomorrow, well, this is what we're going to do, I would address this problem of the Americans just showing up once in a while and doing an exercise and moving along by making full use of the port and the down in Darwin, Northern Australia. And it's got an excellent harbor there, port facilities, and you'd have to build them up a little bit, but and it's got airfields in that area, the Northern Territories of Australia. And I would put in a sort of an U.S.-Australian Marine Expeditionary Unit, or an amphibious ready group, and beef it up. And I would have it operate up in the region as much as it possibly can. So you're there, you have this, if not permanent, you have this much more frequent than is currently the case, U.S.-Australian presence up into that bathtub that I'm talking about. So you could get more time on target, in effect, if you made use of Darwin, put a decent amphibious force down there, decent air forces as well, and had them operate up into the region. That would sort of greatly, I think that would increase what we're doing there a lot. We'd be around, people would notice us. And that tends to sort of have a positive effect in its own right. And additionally, if you're going to draw people to you, you know, Darwin and that area makes an excellent sort of training area, school area, where you can bring in friendly foreign forces to train, learn together, etc. And even, you know, who knows, make it into a multinational MU at some point, add some others to it. You know,
all based out of Darwin.
And that's where I would start.
Okay.
Because you need a launch pad, and that is friendly territory. So that I would start there, and then, you know, move, and then really increase the scale and the nature of operations up in into Southeast Asia. But if I had to prioritize who I wanted to sort of win over, who I want to get on our side.
Right.
I would of those ASEAN nations, you know, I'd try to do several things at once. Actually, I think I would try to convince the Malaysians that, you know, we are serious, and the Indonesians as well, that, you know, these are both places that I think with a sort of one more of a military presence, and it doesn't have to be a huge one. It's, as I've suggested before, is you take a good half dozen of the right officers, and I'm just speaking from a Marine perspective, the right guys put into these countries who can influence, you would find the payoff to be sort of exponential. But you've got to be there influencing. Additionally, it's going to take the entire U.S. government to do something sort of together, and you're going to need obviously a diplomatic approach, but also an economic approach to it. You know, you show people that there's more to it than just telling the Chinese no, but if they side with us, there's economic benefits in particular, and we're going to, plus the military's we're going to be there, we're going to be around to sort of potentially protect you. The more you do for us, and the more you do for yourself, the better that's going to be. Singapore, of course, is pretty much on our side, but they've shown some signs of wavering in the in sort of trying to hedge their bets between us and the Chinese a little more than is comfortable in the last few years. But Singapore is down there. But Singapore is so small that you want is, you know, we have a good relationship, and they do let us use one of their Navy bases, Singapore alone is not enough to shape or affect ASEAN, the Southeast Asian nations, but it's something you've really got to have. But I would probably go with Indonesia and Malaysia first, and then I would try to make up with Thailand. The Obama administration did their best to humiliate the Thai leadership after a coup. I forget when that was, 2014-ish, 13-14. And the Thais took offense and said, okay, well, we'll get closer to the Chinese. And that's what they've done. But the Chinese have made some inroads militarily into Thailand. But we still have we still have some capabilities there. And, you know, we have a decent relationship with them, but it can only be made better if we make the effort to do that. And I am a big believer really in sort of a permanent presence. And by that, I don't mean having, like, you know, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marine stationed at, you know, in Thailand or somewhere, but rather have a small number of the right kind of officers, and not just Marines, but the other services as well, the right guys who can get in there and keep your, and say, influence. The current Marine they've got down there is a fellow named John Basile, who's excellent. He's a perfect example of the kind of guy we want. He's with the, whatever they call it, JustMag, the Joint U.S. Military Assistant Group for Thailand. So he's not really a Marine liaison officer, but he is really very, very good, a perfect example of the kind of difference one guy can make. So, you know, we have a, you know, sort of a good sort of infrastructure from which to work, and we do good exercises, and but we need to do one more of it, and we also need to be there permanently, have this permanent presence, so we're not out of sight, out of mind. And when it comes to amphibious forces, you've got to, if you're not selling them, it's not like the Army, the Air Force, or the Navy is going to pay much attention. So you've got to help the local amphibious forces to sort of survive and ideally sort of improve and thrive even. But so you're the Philippines, you know, we're that too, is important as well. So it's in terms of priority, that can be a little bit tricky because they're, you know, which side of the bathtub don't you want to have on your side? You're trying to sort of keep that as solid a line as possible. But I would, if they said, look, you got to choose, I would see what I could accomplish with Indonesia and Malaysia. And then we have some existing equities and influence in the Philippines, and I would be trying to work that as well. But we're new, a new effort, be made Indonesia, Malaysia, I would start. And then just, you know, if the U.S. government were to just treat the, almost apologize to the Thais for how we treated them a few years back, that we could sort of, we'd do well with that chunk of the Thai ruling class that does like America. But we've haven't helped ourselves down there. So that would be my, how I would approach it. And then Cambodia, I'd let it stew.
The all right. Do you so as I look at this, our presence in Darwin, a presence in Indonesia, nowhere on here was Vietnam.
Oh, because I just didn't, you know, I was feeling too loquacious by the time I got to that. But Vietnam, it's, you can see the opportunities, and that's one actually where you, it's. Because they, because the Vietnam, you know, how would you put it? I'm not sure we really have to do all that much to win them over. It's some reason it's less of a selling job with the Vietnamese because they simply don't like the Chinese in general, and that goes back 1,000+ years. That, you know, that dislike is so intense that they are not going to allow say Chinese bases or any sort of Chinese military presence in Vietnam, whereas the other countries in the region, particularly Malaysia, Thailand, Cambodia, even the Philippines, it's, that is something that's definitely in play, but not in Vietnam. So that works to our favor. These are people who are opposed to China, and they is, I think, as most Americans know, or certain age know, they will fight. And so what we have to do is to make sure that we pay enough attention to them and take advantage of opportunities to sort of have a presence there, and even don't overlook opportunities for others to help us out. The Indians, for example, I think actually have trained Vietnamese submariners on how to operate their Soviet subs. The Japanese are very popular in Vietnam, and that's, so there's a limited role the Japanese could play for us there. So it doesn't have to be just an American show, and I think the Australians as well would probably be welcome in Vietnam.
Do you think the more it's not simply, for instance, the significance of the Australian Navy being in the South China Sea, I think is huge. Because it's not just, you know, the Americans and you know, because the Chinese say it all the time. Hey, look, the Americans are just going to come through. We stay, which is, I mean, you said that about, you said that a few minutes ago. The significance that it being a somewhat of a regional alliance that includes India, I think is much more economically powerful. And that's why, to me, the whole, whether President Trump wants to do bilateral agreements with all these nations, but he's got to open up the diplomatic and the economic door, and then the military, you know, follows through that door. And so you can see, you know, you can see how significant it is, and it being multinational, I think is huger, if I could make up a word.
Oh, that's what it is, and that's really ideally what it needs to be. And you know, we take whoever we can get to join in. That's what you want, and the more countries in on it, the better. Well, I don't know. Say the more the better. That tends to almost dilute the effect sometimes because it gets so unwieldy. But when you do have the Australians, even the Japanese, the Indians, and the Americans, which is kind of that the so-called Quad that you hear talked about. A good basic structure that you want to use. And as you said, make it multinational, and it's not just military, but there's got to be a decent economic component to it. So there is some alternative to the China market for a lot of these countries, but and an adequate diplomatic presence that's doing more than just writing reports about what's going on, but rather is influencing and pushing U.S. interests in these areas beyond sternly worded notes and having tea with people, but people who actually know how to get things done. That is much more effective than us trying to do it on our own. And I don't think we could succeed, given the really impressive sort of strength, which China has built up in a number of areas, that it without that sort of a multi, without sort of a it being a multinational effort, it'd be very, very difficult. But we do have something to work with. We've got friends in the region. And, you know, if you do get us and the Indians, the Japanese, the Australians out doing more, but then you'll find others sometimes come down off the fence and are willing to do, say, things with us as well that previously they wouldn't have. But you've got to make the initial effort and have a little success to show people you're serious before they're willing to sort of come out and risk provoking China's displeasure.
All right. I want to talk about the next time. I have one more question, and I want to set up the next time we talk. There was an article written entitled "Inside Indo-Pacific Command's $20 billion Wish List to Deter China and Why Congress May Approve It." It talks about the European Deterrence Initiative, known as the EDI, which was set in motion years ago, and you're seeing the manifestation of that now in exercises well further east of than, you know, United States forces normally operate in. Poland is you know, you're seeing, you know, more things than up near the Baltic, and so the idea of all this is to convey to, you know, the Russians that anything you might undertake is, it would be, you wouldn't win, and, you know, it's just simply not worth doing. And the same thing is being considered in the Pacific. And so I want to talk about that with you. I'll send you the article and you can take a look at it. But it's this whole idea of, you know, this pivot to the Pacific. Well, and my thoughts about it are this, and we'll talk about it next time. And that is this: you can't lead with the military. If you don't have the diplomatic and the economic pieces in place, you're just driving around and making noise. You're not going to be welcomed because you haven't done the other things that are necessary steps of real power, you know, in terms of getting a nation to come close to you, because you have this incredibly beneficial, and we as the United States, our economy, Canada, Mexico, the European Union, we have incredible stuff to offer them in terms of access to our markets that could fundamentally change the way of life in many of these countries. But this whole idea that we're going to lead with the military, to me, is nonsensical. And I want to talk about that with you the next time. So, and then I have, if you don't mind, and so I have one more question, and that is, Mac, could Grant give us what he believes is China's hard currency issue relative to the COVID economic disaster that is about to happen to them? So we've talked about this before, but there's a triple whammy waiting for China because it's such a manufacturing power, as the world's economy now slows down based on the coronavirus. So your thoughts on how that impacts their need for hard currency?
I think it's really, they're in trouble. If you just read the newspapers, you would think that, well, China's kind of handled this virus pretty well and their economy is picking back up. That's what they report, but I don't believe it. Their export demand is really just dropped off the cliff. And plus their business, you know, they announced that all their businesses are back up and running, but nobody believes that. You know, unemployment in China, I think, is huge as a reflection of the effect this has had on their economy. And if you're not exporting, you're not earning foreign exchange. And so that leaves you to count on the Goldman Sachs's of the world and the America's financial collapse class to bring in money into the country. But that gives them a lifeline of sorts. But the real money they were making was from exports, and that is it has dried up just the way that, you know, our own economy has kind of, you know, I don't know if it's come to a halt, but it kind of has. It's the same. You look at what's happened to us. Why would China be any different?
Right.
Probably even a little worse in some ways. because we at least have dollars. So I think this is something that really needs to be watched. And I don't think, unfortunately, it doesn't get the attention. And I say, unfortunately, the U.S. government still hasn't cracked down on U.S. financial institutions investing and putting money into China. If they were to do that, that would be something well worth considering in terms of the effect. Because, you know, when you know China, you read all the time about China buying some new port in some part of the world. They have to pay with foreign exchange, with dollars. Well, the fewer dollars they have, the fewer of these things they can do. But if we keep funding them, it's it's almost as if we want to lose. But this is something. It's the reader, the listener, they're really onto it. And if you follow all this, it's amazing just how little attention this particular aspect gets. There's one guy worth listening to in the financial community, and he's on the internet, and his name is Kyle Bass. Bass, and he's really good, and he's from that the high end of our financial class, but he's the one who has sized up China perfectly, and he's got some fairly short interviews that are very good that do get to the financial vulnerabilities of the People's Republic of China. It's worth a little time.
All right, sir. What are we going to see next from you in terms of writing?
Oh, boy. I haven't decided yet. I've got a couple largest projects sort of dealing with sort of the broader issues in Asia. But in terms of the little, sort of the shorter things, I'd write something about globalization, I think. And that may be the...
Globalization, that's fairly generic. There's a lot of room to maneuver under that one.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Particularly slanted towards what? Globalization of what? Globalization to what end?
Oh, the thing is, it's become a dirty word, as if it's something new.
It is. But it is a dirty word.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's my point, is that it's a dirty word because we let China into the WTO. We let China into the international trade economy without requiring them to follow the rules. And then this was made even worse by our sort of pedigreed CEO MBA class of businessmen that pushed all of so much of our industry overseas, a lot of it to China. And so globalization gets tarred with the with a bad connotation. In fact, you'll find that what the better word for it is sinosization. Not globalization. So we're picking on the wrong thing. Plus, you will notice how that it's thrown around like an insult whenever anyone says, we shouldn't be, giving the game away to China. They're then accused of, well, you're against globalization. It's one of these words that has lost all meaning, and it's, in fact, used as a weapon. But we've always done international trade. You'll find these old shipwrecks, say, in the Mediterranean of some Phoenician boat that has amphora full of wine on it at the bottom of the sea, and, they were trading. So that my point is that that's all – foreign trade has always been around, and that is globalization. But it's the meaning is become different, and what I would focus on is this surrender, just national suicide that we tried to pull off with the Chinese over the last 30 years. So that's kind of how I would try to shape the issue.
All right. Well, let us know. We'll certainly be interested in discussing that with you, Grant. Thank you as always for staying up late, and thanks for the visit.
Sure, anytime. Glad to do it.
All right, there you have it. The one and only Allmarine Radio favorite, Grant Newsham here. All right, if you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. Hour one, pretty interesting, smart guys, who I saw a little snippet of, and so I went looking for a longer version, and that's what you're going to hear today. You're going to hear two doctors that work up in Kern County, which is Bakersfield, So you got to go north of Los Angeles. You go over the mountains to separate Southern California from Northern California, actually from Central California, the fertile San Joaquin Valley. Yeah. A little California geography here. And the first big city is Bakersfield. So they work up in the Bakersfield area. And what they talk about is data. Yep. They talk about data that should drive not the initial response, which was done out of caution and ignorance, literal term, with no editorial significance. But they talk about the data, and I think it's really interesting, and where the data should be driving decision makers. And so you'll hear that. So, don't touch that dial. And then Grant Newsham, interesting today, covered everything from should Theodore Roosevelt have gone into port, and got Grant's opinion on that, if he were the head of Indo-PACOM. And kind of walked us around the geography. I will tell you, when you look at a map, the geography of the South China Sea is... is confusing. Malaysia in and of itself is is confusing, right? So you have, you know, Malaysia. Singapore is its own country, right? So on the Malaysian Peninsula, and then across the South China Sea, you have, if you want to call it East Malaysia, you know, you would call it East Malaysia, but it's on the same island as Indonesia. So you could see, and then nestled in the, right, in the center of East Malaysia is Brunei. So, I mean, if you look into master, Southeast Asia, it's not the easiest. It's not the easiest thing in the world. You're gonna have to spend a little bit of time with your map. So, good luck on that deal. Anyway, on a Tuesday, don't touch that dial. All Marine Radio continues right after this. I've got to switch channels, so it'll take me about 15 seconds, maybe, if that. So don't touch that dial. Have a great day. We are over and out.